Hello, great souls. I'm Nyaswami Asha, and we're continuing our sheltering in place morning broadcasts. So let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, Swami Kriyananda, dearest friend, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to thy constant joyous presence within us. Lead us by the hand through the minefields of delusion to the eternal safety of thy love. Om, peace. Amen. I've decided today I wanted to talk about patience. This is Easter Saturday, but we had a good Friday service last night. An hour from now, at 10 o'clock, I'm starting a three-hour retreat based around Swami's oratorio, a combination of listening to the music and then three sections of music and then three sections of my talking about the life of Christ. In normal times, we would do that as a sing-along. But since we can't sing along, this is how we'll do it. And on Sunday, we'll have our Easter service. So I'm going to pretend it's not Easter Saturday because there's so much of that all around. And I'm just going to talk as I would on any other day, as if anything was normal right now. But anyway, in the context of the new normal, let's just do what we're doing. So I wanted to talk about patience. So here's from Swami's Affirmations and Prayers. Patience, it has been well said, is the shortest path to God. To attune the heart to the rhythms of eternity, one must first adjust himself to life's longer rhythms. He should not allow his mind to become absorbed in concentration on the little ripples at the surface of the sea. Patience means also adjusting to whatever is in life, rather than wishing it were something else. Patience is a prerequisite for every type of success. For it is when we work with things as they are that we can change them to whatever we might like them to be. The affirmation for patience is, I am neither the ripples at the surface of the sea, nor yet the crashing waves. I am the vast ocean deeps, unaffected by mighty surface storms, untouched by any superficial change. Then his prayer, long have I called thee, Lord, but thou hast not answered me. Ah, but for what long eons didst thou endure my fickleness in this life, Lord, and if need be through eternity, I will keep calling thee. Here's also, a friend sent me this, a book of poems, Becoming Water, by a poet named Casey Howe, who appears to be a Buddhist. Short little poem. Disappointment needs two opposing forces, how it is and how you want it to be. The moment, however, is singular. It has no choice but to accept itself. I thought that was such a perfect statement, and it does relate. Now, when I was thinking about patience, this is how it came to me. Well, there's multiple ways it came to me. There's the word tapasya, which generally means austerity, which generally means, you know, in people's minds, when they think of austerity, they think some kind of suffering, some kind of denial, some kind of disappointment, not getting something that we want. When we were in our 70s, in the 70s, we are in our 70s now, but in the 1970s at Ananda Village, when we were all just starting out what we were doing, we were still living there with Swamiji, and we were receiving spiritual names if we asked him, and he would choose a name, meditate on a name, and offer it to you. It wasn't a cooperative project, really, although occasionally people protested. This one rather woman with a very outgoing personality, Swami called her Kripa, which means grace. And it's a beautiful name. It's an absolutely wonderful name to have. But she just couldn't get out of her head that it sounded like creep. And so Swami did change her name to Kanta. But most of the time, he just gave you a name and you loved it and you lived with it. But there was always the fear that you would get a variation on the name Tapasya, because it was sort of a joke among us, but that's how we felt about it. I know people have been named that, not by Swami as far as I know. But when I read somewhere that Sri Yukteswar defined the word Tapasya as patience, I've also heard another definition of the word Tapasya, which is devotion. And patience, devotion, and Tapasya are actually very interesting words to put all together. I had a profound learning experience in a very mundane way about a dozen years ago when I shifted from where I had been living into this house where I'm living now. And even though now I've replaced all the curtains with Venetian blinds, for the first few years that we were here, I put curtains up. And for some reason, even though I have absolutely no experience and no skill with hammer, nails, or screwdriver, although I have a little kit, a little tool kit that I got from Sharper Image, I don't have any ability to do that sort of thing. But I decided that I would put up the curtain rods myself in about 6 different windows, which was not a small job. All of them actually required a ladder and all kinds of things. And I don't know why I decided, except that it was God-inspired, and I spent several weeks struggling to get the curtain rods up. And when I finally did, you know, they were fine. They were not always in a plumb line, you know, like this. And I'd had to pull out screws and put, I can't remember what it's called now, but the stuff that you put in the hole and then had to paint it over again. And I just kept at it. And what I gradually figured out, and, you know, it's very interesting to do things that you're not good at. It's also interesting to do things that you're not good at that are not important to you to be good at, because then there's a whole sort of release of egoic involvement in it that is quite different. I learned to cook from Swami Kriyananda. I was running the kitchen at the seclusion retreat at the time. I had a great interest in food because I was sort of a health fanatic, so I knew all about that aspect of food, but I didn't have any relationship to food as the taste of it is actually what I want to say. If it was healthy, it was good. Even to this day, I have a very plain palate left to my own devices. I eat in a very plain manner. But I was cooking for the whole community. And I was also determined to follow certain rules. No packaged goods, you know, no canned goods, no sugar, as organic, as fresh as possible, locally grown, all these different things. So when the garden at Ananda Village was producing, and it was more in the fall and winter, and what they were primarily producing was a huge amount of this vegetable called Jerusalem artichoke and kale. And kale at that time was not a favorite. Now kale is like everybody has kale. You go to expensive restaurants and they serve you kale. Kale was extremely obscure, lunatic fringe health food and not considered to be very good. Jerusalem artichokes are still rather marginalized as a food, and with reasons that I quite understand. They're quite good raw, I think. Sort of, they have a carrot-like texture. But I have yet to find a single way of cooking them that I, who am really not very particular, can hardly palate. But at that time, I just cooked Jerusalem artichokes and kale, just day after day after day. And my constituency finally appealed desperately to Swamiji because they could hardly stand what I was cooking for them. And he, in his inimitable fashion, it was really a remarkable time, he approached me so delicately, you know, to see if I would be receptive. I mean, it's hard to get people to run kitchens, so you don't just throw someone away who's willing to do it, which I was. The fact that I wasn't a very good cook was unfortunate, but I was willing otherwise. But when he saw that I was receptive, and that I really, by that point, I realized I really needed to make food taste better. I just didn't know how. I really literally didn't know how. Swami later said that I was so lost in my mental concepts that I literally couldn't taste it. And I think that was true. So I spent a weekend with Swami cooking for a guest that he had. And Swami taught me to cook by my standing next to him, chopping vegetables and washing dishes. And that's what I did. I was there with a notebook to take notes, but soon became folly because he cooks in a very intuitive manner. But after that weekend, on Monday morning, I knew how to cook. And I knew how to cook intuitively. I just knew how it was supposed to be done. And I realized that one of the reasons I was able to be so receptive to that was because I didn't think it was important. And therefore, whether I was good or bad at it, I didn't have any ego involvement in it. So that's one side of it. There's a freedom when there's no self-worth at stake. So when I took up this carpentry, so to speak, this house repair, there was no self-worth at stake. It was just something I was going to do. And what I discovered has actually served me profoundly ever since. I realized that every achievement in life is the patient application of willpower. And see, that's the pair that you have to put with the word patience. You can be patient. You can just sit there like a lump and wait. But you can be patient and wait a very long time, and you won't have, as Swami says, you won't have any success, because you haven't actually applied yourself, you know, to manifest a new reality from the present reality. So the patient application of willpower is what really gives patience its power. Because what I really figured out, first in carpentry and later in writing this book, 220,000 words, which became possible, honestly, because of those curtain rods. Because I realized that if I just didn't quit, but kept going back and putting out effort, that sooner or later I would get it right. I discovered you put the screw in the wrong place, you pull it out. You have a hole in the wall. There's stuff that you can get where you fill that hole. Then you have a spot on the wall. Then you can get the paint that matches the spot. I mean, all of this may be self-evident to others. But seeing it in a sphere that wasn't my sphere, where the tension of self-worth was involved, I was able to just really observe it in a most impersonal manner, and I could break it down to its component parts, and then I gradually realized that those components were generic. And so whereas when, for example, I would try to write something and it didn't come out right, or I didn't have an idea, or somebody would criticize it, there would be all this cascading series of self-involved egoic reactions that would then lead to disappointment, which is this poem that I was reading, which would lead to disappointment where there are opposing forces, my desire to be good and the reality that I wasn't, and therefore how it is and how you want it to be. And those two opposing forces would basically use up all my energy, and the desire to have it be a certain way caused me to fail in Swami's instructions, where he says, patience is a prerequisite for every kind of success, for it is when we work with things as they are that we can change them to whatever we might like them to be. And so we find ourselves on the spiritual path with this ideal of what's possible. Many years ago, many, many years ago, there was a magazine called Psychology Today. I don't know if it still exists. And when meditation was becoming very popular, they wrote an article, well, popular in the 70s, it was just beginning to come forward, and they called it The Dark Side of Meditation. We were so amused by that title. It still tickled me. The Dark Side of Meditation. I mean, I'm talking an article that was written 45 years ago. I used to have a copy, but I gave it up finally. The dark side of meditation was this, which is, if you're meditating with self-realization as the goal, what you're seeking is absolute perfection. And many people who were drawn to meditation at that time especially, were people who were highly stressed, who were looking for a way to ease their stress, but then they took on meditation as the challenge to become perfect. And then that effort always to become perfect created a whole new level of stress. And so this was called the dark side of meditation. But it wasn't untrue. I remember when the Nyaswami order started, and there were several vows that a person could take. Essentially, there were novice vows and final vows. Novice vows, tyagi and brahmachari, for married couples or single people who wish to stay single. And Nyaswami was the final vow, whether married or single, if you think of it in traditional monastic terms. So naturally, it would be most logical for most people to start with a novice vow and then take a final vow. Many of us went right to the Nyaswami vow, but that was if we had been, as we had been, with Ananda for decades, and essentially had already served our novitiate. But somebody was talking to me about wanting to join the Nyaswami order. I said, what vow do you want to take? Because by then there was also a pilgrim vow, which was even, you might call it, I don't know, there might be a word for it, but an intention. It's an intention. You've declared your intention, but it isn't even yet a novitiate. And so those were the options available, and the person said to me, well, I want to take the Nyaswami vow. And it did not seem like an appropriate choice. So I asked the person, why? And the response was, well, it's the highest and best vow. So, of course, I would go for the top. And so that's how we tend to approach the spiritual path. I want to be Jivan Mukta. I want to be free. And all of that is valid, and Swami, even a master, encourages us to realize, as Jesus said, that which I do, ye shall do in greater things. Be therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. But then between the realization or the understanding of our potential and the realization of where we stand, that's where people leave the path, because they suddenly see there's tremendous disappointment in realizing that my aspiration is farther out of my reach than I thought it was. You know, a lot of the spiritual path is the gradual acquisition of humility. And humility, as Swami describes it, is not self-abnegation. It's not pouring dust on your own head and saying that you're worthless and you're nothing. Humility, Master defined beautifully, as simply self-honesty. Humility is just knowing who you are. You, may have very fine qualities. And self-honest, and it is humble to say, yes, you know, I'm good at that. I can sing. I can write. I know how to speak. I have compassion for people. It's not ego to say that. If it's a fact, it's a fact. It's ego to deny it, because you're actually just denying the truth and acting as if it matters. You see, to deny that you have virtues, to deny that you have talent, is actually acknowledging that the ego wants to have those things, so I have to repudiate it. And the repudiation is in itself an affirmation of their importance, you see? But if it's just is what it is, God can work through me in these ways, then God can work through me in these ways. It's a denial of God working through you to say otherwise. So humility is just acknowledging what is. So the process of the spiritual path is, you see, from the egoic idea that this is the highest vow, so I'm going to take it, to the realization that I have to start where I am if I'm ever going to be able to shift things to what I want to be. I have seen in myself and others a kind of odd desire to try to work out someone else's karma. It's just kind of a karma that looks like more fun to us. I don't mean you're actually going to Sally and trying to work out her karma, but rather than having the humility and the self-honesty to know what it is that I need to work on, we get some theoretical idea of who we are and what our karma is. And see, with that humility and with that self-honesty comes the realization that this is a long project. I remember about 5 years into the path, I really realized what a long project this was. And it wasn't that I sort of crashed and burned on the realization of my own limitations. It was just that I began to realize what perfection really was. I mean, how would I know what perfection was? You read in a book, but you have to be trying to live it day after day and watching one's own actual reactions to things, the degree of unsettlement and paying attention with honest introspection and regular meditation. I began to appreciate in my early years of meditation that, I mean, sometimes I had wonderful experiences in meditation, but often what disturbed my meditation was more important than the peace I felt meditating. Because what disturbed my meditation was the arising from within me when I was not distracted by external things of my true thoughts and feelings. And that the necessity then to realize this is what I have to work on. This is who I really am. It won't serve me to pretend that this isn't true. In the moment, there is only one reality and we have to accept it. But then once we accept that reality, much patience is required. And then that's where the tapasya comes. We have to the patient application of willpower. And both things are true, because willpower, you know, just in a big burst of wild energy, maybe can move some things, but the kind of transformation that is really the transformation of the spiritual path is the application of willpower like a drop of water on a stone. It's just day after day after day after day of making one's best effort, and then at the end of the day, reflecting as the way the Bhagavad Gita, the whole allegory of the Bhagavad Gita, what did they on the field of battle? Between superconsciousness and my subconscious habits, between the subconscious self that I've always been, the superconscious self that is my destiny that I aspire to become, they were battling on the field of Kurukshetra, which is my conscious mind. What did they? What forces were arrayed together? And who won? And then we have to appraise the forces and the conflict for the next day, so to speak. And in our next meditation, we have to pray to God for the grace to understand. And then we start over with the patient application of willpower. I really came to understand that, especially when I was writing, you know, many people start out to write a book and many people don't finish. And I didn't finish several times before I did finish. And I just came to understand the patient application of willpower. When I was alone in seclusion, and now this really mattered to me, so it took me much longer before I could separate myself from the impatience of disappointment and have the two warring forces. I want to be able to do this, I can't do it, and then collapsing in despair between the two. What did they on the field of battle? Well, she was defeated. She was defeated by disappointment because she was putting one against the other rather than looking in the moment and seeing what needed to be done. By the time I was able to write that book in seclusion, and it was one of the greatest blessings of my life to have the seclusion and the way I put it, which was true, just have all that time with Swamiji. I just really understood because everything was stripped away. I had no contact with people, and I had no internet for one of the places I stayed. I went into town once a week to buy food and to get emails. But in my daily basis, I had nothing to do except there was the manuscript and there was the computer. But I had understood by that point that if I just looked at the project at hand and did not look at the huge boxes of files that were over there, I just looked at the project at hand, 1993, January. What happened in January 1993? Work it out, write it down. Work out February. Work it out, write it down. In the moment is singular, and the only task at hand is this. Swami Kriyananda had nothing good to say about multitasking. Dividing your attention among various things he thought was a recipe for absolute disaster and mediocrity. He was absolutely focused on what he did, and from time to time, in my Gemini way, I would burst in on him and try to distract him. I remember he was reading a letter once, and I just wanted him to talk to me and answer my question. He wasn't, how would I say it? He didn't bother to be rude to me. He just absolutely ignored me. He was reading a letter, and he wasn't going to stop what he was concentrating on just because I was impatient. It was the patient application of willpower. He would finish reading the letter. Then he would give his full attention to me, just like that. You see, when we're doing several things at once, we're always fighting with ourselves. We don't know what the moment is, because the moment is 16 different things. You know, patient application of willpower. There are many phrases over the course of my 50-some years on the spiritual path now that stand out in my mind. But countless times when I feel myself agitated, disappointed, guilt-ridden, pressured, I can't possibly do it, the solution comes, the patient application of willpower. And it's tapasya, because tapasya is the relinquishing of the peripheral to concentrate on the main thing. We discipline ourselves to push everything aside so that we can accomplish the one goal we're trying to accomplish. We build energy. And tapasya is devotion. And tapasya is patience. A great athlete does not go out and party every night. A great athlete does not indulge appetites that hurt his physical body. A great athlete does not stay up late playing video games when he has an important competition the next day. Others might think of it as tapasya, but it's actually devotion. It's devotion to the goal that we know is worthwhile. So as devotees, the goal is bliss, and that's a goal that's worthwhile. It's God realization. It's freedom from fear. And the way we get there is with patient application of willpower, realizing that there's no point in, as Swami says, patience is the fastest way to God. It's actually the only way to God. Because when we become impatient, we're living in disappointment. We're creating a conflict between two realities. When we're patient, it's just, I'm standing here, and I have to get there, and the only way I'm going to get there is by walking. And if I just put one foot in front of the other, writing a book, and this was my fourth, not my first, but the first book that I wrote, it is Swami Kriyananda as we've known him, and it's episodic. It's short vignettes of his life. And I was able to finish each one completely. That's how I wrote it. I finished each one completely and put it away. And I stopped counting and I stopped looking at the file. I just saw a task in front of me that I knew how to do. This is how I tricked my mind into writing that book. I didn't know how to write a book, but I knew how to write a 500 or a 700 word story. So I would just write one story and then I'd put it away. And it was most interesting. It was almost like at some point I looked back. Of course, it wasn't physical because it's all on the computer. But I looked back, and what do you know? There was a book. And it had never been a strain. It was just the patient application of willpower. And what happens to us, there's that wonderful story of the disciple who comes young, and the guru asks him to chop wood and carry water. And he chops wood and carries water, and the guru never asks him to do anything else. And then one day he catches a sight of his own reflection in a pool of water and realizes that he's become an old man. And all he's ever done is chop wood and carry water. And he begins to weep. And before his tears can strike the ground, the guru runs out and catches his tears. He said, if a great saint like you cries and your tears fall on this land, it will be a curse on this land and drought will come for 7 years. And then the guru touched him and he was liberated because he simply patiently did what was in front of him lived in that moment, and then victory was his. God bless you.